I want you to travel with me back to 1952. You are a boy. It's January 13th, your 12th birthday. But you aren't celebrating. You're standing in the cold and snow, with snow beginning to fall, as it has for the past several days. The place is St. Stephen's Catholic Church Cemetery in St. Stephen's, Nebraska. You have traveled here by train from St. Louis. You watched as your mother's remains were taken from the baggage car and transferred to a hearse. You saw the wreath of what was beautiful roses. Now, because of the cold, they had turned black. In the evening, there was another wake, as there had been in Illinois. Like the two in Illinois, you were the invisible one. People expressed their sympathy and condolences to your father and your brother, 12 years your senior. But you sat alone, looking at the figure in the casket, holding a rosary. The figure which had once been a woman of 185 pounds, now after 2 years and 15 major surgeries, less than half that weight. Back at the cemetery, the casket was being lowered into the ground. You went back to the car along with your cousin, a girl named Nellie. You were both crying. Your two uncles shoved a dollar bill in your hand and told you, "Stop blubbering, be a man." The next year was a string of caretakers while your father tried to save his farm. In the end, your dad lost the farm. The main reason was because of the expense incurred by your mother's illness and major surgeries. In those days, a woman wasn't insured. Neither health nor life insurance was purchased for a woman. After all, she wasn't the breadwinner. She was just a housewife. You, along with your father, moved to Nebraska to live with your dad's parents. This was quite a blow to a man to have to move back home at age 48. The loss of his dream, which was the farm, along with his wife of 27 years, then having to move in with his parents. He was saddled with a boy whom he did not know. On the farm, he and your older brother were in the fields before you got up and did not come in till after you had gone to bed. These were the major reasons that caused your father to climb into a bottle. Your father had always been a heavy drinker. Now it was a daily occurrence. If you wished to see your father, you had to go to the bars. Your father would then send you to the movies. There were only two movie theaters in Hastings. At other times, he would send you off with one of his bar friends. These bar friends often would take you to some secluded area and sexually molest you. You would learn later that this was a way your father to finance his drinking. At other times, you met with a group of boys you hung around with. There was numerous moves, one to Omaha aboard a Coors Brewery truck. Your father dumped you in Boys Town, only to take you out after 3 months. The series of moves stopped when you were 16, when your father remarried a woman with 5 children of her own. 2 sons were still at home. At 17, you enlisted in military service. This wasn't to last. 3 months later, you received a medical discharge. You returned to Omaha. A few months later, your dad and stepmother decided to buy a restaurant in Iowa. It was decided you would not move with them. You would be allotted $50 allowance to cover all your expenses in Omaha. You began forging checks on your dad, and when you were at the restaurant on weekends, stole money. This was a trait you had learned from years of running with street gangs. After the breakup with a girl you had gone with for over 2 years, you took a bottle and a half of Somanex sleeping tablets in an attempt to commit suicide. You were discovered, rushed to the county hospital. Your stomach was pumped, Your father came and got you and took you to the restaurant. There, after feeding you several dares, he made an off-colored comment about the girl you were dating. You grabbed your father in what turned out to be a chokehold. He passed out. This was to become a news cycle, a news cycle of nightmares. You see, you never drank alcohol. You awoke the next morning to a pounding head and someone pounding on the door. The person turned out to be the sheriff who would take you to the state mental hospital at Clarinda, Iowa. This was 1958. The time between this committal and August of 1961 are missing, are very blurred. The result of electric shock. The next that you remember is sitting in a day hall looking through a glass partition of the nursing station at a calendar with the date August 1961. You were in the Lincoln State Hospital in Lincoln, Nebraska. For the next 9 years, you would be in and out of the hospital for a total of 6 years. You would receive a total of 62 electric shocks. In those days, electric shock wasn't administered as it is today. You were not allowed to eat prior to treatment. When the treatment came, when the time came for the treatment, you were taken in, strapped to a bed. You weren't given any relaxant or any sedative. When the doctor giving the treatment got near you, a gag was placed in your mouth. The metal probes were placed on your temples. You heard the words, "treat," followed by blackness. When you regained consciousness, you had a very severe headache. Loss of memory was also part of the results. One of the doctors at the Lincoln Regional Center, as the state hospital was called, experimented on his patients with drugs. Some of these drugs, on several occasions, caused you severe pain. Your muscles contracted to the extent that you were frozen in a fetal position for several hours. Another drug was LSD, which was administered not orally, but intravenously. This type of drug experimentation would cost the lives of several patients. Two were teenage boys, 14 and 16. I might add that this doctor also took these drugs himself. This would cost him his life also. While you were out of the hospital, you married a young lady you had met in the hospital. The marriage would last 7 years. During that time, you spent less than 3 months together as man and wife. The rest of the time, she was in the hospital. When the marriage ended, you met another lady at the state hospital. She and you would be married for almost 20 years. She would bear you 3 sons. Were the 20 years happy ones? Not really. You could not keep a job most of the time. Your wife became the main source of income. You were subject to fits of violent rage. At these times, you were both physically and emotionally abusive. One last rage caused your wife to leave. She would file for divorce. You would swear that you would never be abusive to another person. This is a promise you have kept for 23 years. It came too late for you and your former family. Today, you have no idea where your two of your sons are and your ex-wife. You have not heard from them in 20 years. One that lives locally, you have not heard from in almost a year. As Unitarian Universalists, we hold certain principles like the inherent worth and dignity of every person. How do we apply this principle with a person as the person in this story? Do we allow for the person who have the same social graces as we have, skills that society as a whole have come to expect? Do we take into account that maybe, just maybe, the person has not had the same opportunities as we have had? That may be where that person has been. There have been a different set of rules. or worse, no rules except for the law of survival. A person does not learn many social graces running with street gangs or in mental institutions. I believe that many do not choose to deal with this situation. Like the story of the beggar at the banquet table in the Christian Bible, we let the person like this have crumbs and ignore them. Fortunately, this is not always the case. Some people really care and give this type of person a chance to succeed. The congregation is composed of such persons. I do not know about other UU congregations, but here at Booth, the members do pretty well. Are the members perfect? Do they live up to each principle every day to perfection? No, they don't. They are like the human race who is working on building a better world. They try most of the time. You see, if Booth members and humankind were perfect or even near perfect, then there would be no work to do, no lessons to learn. The world would be perfect. And that, as we all know, is far from a reality. I know because, you see, the story I have just told you in this presentation is my own. I am the person in the story. It is my story. There is much more to it, but time will not allow me to tell the whole story. In 2006, I gave a presentation in which I told the first 11 years of my life. I said then I'd finish the story later. Time, I have kept my word. My story is not a pretty one. It's filled with sadness and failures. For me, two things have helped me survive. The first is in the past 20 years, I have changed how I look at the negative life gives me. Instead of crying out, why me? I ask myself, what is the lesson? What can I learn from this that will make this a positive learning experience rather than a negative event? The second is faith. Faith that tomorrow will be better than today. Faith that I will continue to be alive. Faith that I will continue to learn lessons in the school of life. Faith that the light, however dim, at the end of the tunnel, isn't a train.